This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's been 35 years since Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard started the 92nd Naturalist. In that time, he's broadcast more than 9,000 episodes to educate listeners about the natural world on subjects ranging from gender bender bugs to owl cell phones and whale snot. The radio feature airs at 7:30 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.9 WGUC and at 9 p.m. on 91.7 WVXU, along with various times on stations across North America. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the program and his work at the zoo is Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Director Thane Maynard. Thanks so much for being here, Thane.
Thanks, Lucy. It's always nice to see you.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. So, Thane, you started at the zoo how many years ago now?
Yeah, 45 years ago.
45 years ago. And I think I read that your first day was October 31st, 1977, and that your starting salary was $9,000 a year.
That's right.
That, I mean, I know that's a long time ago, but that seems low. Did you feel like you were being underpaid at the time?
Not at all. You know, I'd been a grad student, and the funny part is I was leaving with a master's degree from I was in a PhD program, but I didn't think I had the sort of attention span to stay for 6 years. And so the dean at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources brought me in and said, I don't think you ought to work at the zoo. It's not a good idea. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm a polite Southern Episcopalian, so I didn't say anything to him, but I thought, I'm the only master's student with a job, man. That's $9,000.
Right. Yeah. Big money, yeah. Big money at the time. That's great. So now, 45 years, started in 1977. You did leave briefly and then came back. Tell us about that.
Sure.
And what drew you back to the zoo?
Yeah, well, at the turn of the century, my family and I had an opportunity. We moved to Seattle, and I helped found an outdoor education center, which is a terrific place called Islandwood. It's on Bainbridge Island. And it's kind of like if you had an outdoor ed center, residential outdoor ed center, that was built by Microsoft and Stanford University. I mean, it's a very high quality place. And that was really a lot of fun. It's a beautiful part of the world. But, you know, as I joked before when we were warming up, I said, you can take the boy out of the zoo, but you can't take the zoo out of the boy. A career in a zoo is a lot of fun. It's very active. Just today, before coming down here, I mean, we were wrangling animals, doing all kinds of things. And, you know, I missed that. And having been here for 25 years prior, you know, the zoo was a good fit for me, and I was a good fit for it. So we came back.
Yeah, well, I know the city was excited when you came back. We were all heartbroken when you left. So how long was that absence? Was it a very long time?
Just about a year and a half.
About a year and a half.
Okay. Yeah, we realized, I think if you're going to move to the coast, you know, because it's so expensive and such, you should go when you're really young and sort of build up. Because no kidding, to buy just a regular house like I live in Seattle would be $2 million.
Oh my gosh.
So you better be ready.
Yeah.
So moving there in mid-career, you just can't really do it. Yeah. You can't do it easily.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us, you started talking about just how hectic and interesting it is to work at the zoo. What's day-to-day like for you?
Well, like everybody's job everywhere, if you're working in an organization, that, you know, there's meetings and discussions and plans. But blessedly, the zoo's not a real big organization. We have about 250 full-time employees and an equal number of part-time. And so we're not super process and procedure focused like you'd have to be if you were at a giant company. But there's a lot of interaction. The zoo's a very busy place. You know, anyone who's ever worked at a restaurant or, you know, a hotel where you're greeting guests, well, that's the zoo every single day of the year. And so being an active place, we're out there a lot, dealing both with the public, in our case, with the animals as well. And it's good. You know, it sort of self-selects for hyperactive people.
Yeah, that's great. And how much are you out there yourself? I mean, you're out talking to visitors and talking about animals yourself a whole lot, aren't you?
I am. You know, that old line about managing by walking around. I try to do at least the zoo's main loop twice a day, at the beginning of the day when I get there, and just sort of see where things are, troubleshoot, pick up trash, whatever needs to happen, as well as later in the afternoon. I don't know if you've ever had this happen, but sometimes you eat a big lunch and, man, at about 2:30 in the afternoon, you need a nap. So instead, I walk around the zoo and give everybody trouble.
Yeah.
I will say this. I'm familiar with a lot of zoos in America. I haven't worked in this field so long. Cincinnati's a zoo town. People really love our zoo, and that's a charming thing. You can go from Delhi to Terrace Park and just say to somebody, hey, does your family have any stories about the zoo? And everybody does. You know, their kids went to zoo camp and became veterinarians. I mean, all that kind of thing.
Yeah. What's your favorite zoo story of your own?
Well, my own three daughters grew up at the zoo. I've worked there a long, long time. And they went to zoo camp, and two of them became biologists. Yeah, so be careful what you wish for.
There you go. There you go. So how has the zoo business changed? I thought I read that for another story with you that it used to be a lot more male-dominated, didn't it?
It did indeed. Our zoo and everywhere. Our zoo has long been a really strong zoo. You know, it was founded in 1873. German immigrants like Andrew Erkenbrecher wanted to bring the old world to the new, to build a beautiful garden, which we were and are, and with exotic animals and with cultural events. That said, all the way up through the 70s when I arrived, zoos were simple organizations. They didn't have office workers doing all kinds of things. It was a park, much like if you were, in, say, working with Sensei Parks. Okay, we ran a park, and we had a lot of keepers, and we had a lot of gardeners, and we had a lot of maintenance people. And there were only three people in 77 who had a phone on their desk with like a day job, you know, where the director had an office and his secretary had an office and the guy who counted the money had an office. But there was no fundraising department, marketing department, education department, gift shop. All those things evolved over time. And zoos have become bigger organizations because they're, you know, very popular and we have a lot going on. So it's been heartening to see that really tremendous growth. But yes, at our zoo in 77, it was 1% female. It was the director's secretary. The keepers were all farm boys. They did not have degrees in biology, but they knew animals intuitively from experience, how not to get kicked, how to birth babies, how to keep animals alive. Today, our zoo is 71% female.
Wow.
And almost everybody has a degree in biology, and yet not as much hands-on, you know, much like I'm sure if a family owns a farm. The grandkids all went off and got master's degree in animal husbandry, but they have never milked a cow. You know, there's that kind of thing. So it's a fascinating time in this field.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So I want to get, of course, to the 92nd Naturalist. 35 years of this program. Tell us what inspired you to start it.
Well, in 1987, I was visiting the University of Wisconsin. I went up there to give a talk in the zoology department. And it was long enough ago, people would put up like magic marker signs. And the sign said that the next day in the auditorium, E.O. Wilson, the famous Harvard behavioral ecologist, was going to speak. And I said, well, I'm staying for that. So I did stay. I sneaked in the back, standing room only. I mean, he's one of the greatest biologists since Darwin. And almost everybody there but me was disappointed because he did not give a big, heavy science lecture. He was an expert on ants and on animal behavior and a variety of things. He gave more of a talk for the general public about how scientists need to quit just talking to each other through journal articles that nobody reads. You need to take it to the street. It needs to be on the radio and on TV and newspaper columns and about protecting nature is important for people. And I'm sitting there surrounded by people with, you know, pocket protectors and they're all college professors and grad students thinking, I could do that. And so that's what we did. And we launched it that year and have had a lot of fun with it. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah. So how did you learn to tell the kind of story that you tell in just 90 seconds? Because I've been listening to the 92nd Naturalist for years. Love it. One of my favorite programs. But you pack a lot of really interesting information into a short amount of time. How'd you learn to do that?
Well, in addition to being an animal guy, I am a people person. So one of the main things that a zoo does is tell the story of wildlife, much the same way museums are for that purpose, you know, to tell that story. And so it's a perfect fit. And of course, nature and the way that nature is built is perfect for this kind of format because a brief story gives a chance to catch people's ear and they might be interested in something, but not long enough to bore them. The hilarious part about it is that it was foresight that it was brief because back then there were plenty of shows. There still are some about nature that are maybe 5 minutes long. Well, in today's world, 5 minutes seems like an eternity.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate with the 92nd Naturalist. The actual name sort of grew out of, there was a guy, and I'm not remembering his name, maybe Ken Blanchard, but he had a famous little book of management at the time called The 1 Minute Manager.
Mm.
And the concept was connect with people briefly. But the miracle was the alliteration of that name is why it sold. And I thought, well, what, the 92nd Naturalist, that sounds good. And So that's kind of how it evolved.
Yeah. Do you ever worry about running out of ideas? I mean, 9,000 shows, that's a lot of ideas and 90 seconds at a time. Do you ever worry about running the well running dry?
You know, I really don't, because there's constantly really good research being done in many, many aspects over the years. In fact, if I was able to go back and really look through the long list of shows, they're probably ones that I would do today about research being done on, say, whales that completely contradict something I said in 1988 about what was known about whales, because a lot has been learned in 35 years. And on many species, you know, there are times we have a big lecture series at the zoo, and we'll bring in the world expert on, say, wild dogs, and he'll get up and say, you know, I remember I spoke here 20 years ago, and by the way, all that stuff, now using modern technology, we learn that really wasn't the case. That's the best we could do then, but we realize it's much more complex. So, you know, there's a lot of those opportunities. A fun thing for the show for me is it does keep me always sort of curious, looking like, Smithsonian Magazine, that looks like an interesting idea. I could, you know, do a story like that. So that piece is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, our buddy John Kieswetter did a story for the website, WVXU.org, that talked about the 92nd Naturalist. And in that, it mentioned that you felt like WGUC was a great fit for the show initially because the animals at the zoo listened to WGUC. Is that still something that a lot of the animals listen to?
It is indeed. Some farmers do this too, but in the zoo setting, frequently, especially when the keepers are not there overnight, they will leave on a radio. To be honest, it's not like, oh gosh, I know they want to listen to Rachmaninoff, but it's better than a totally silent building. And their thinking on that is, if noisy things happen, like a car backfires or there's a siren or something just, you know, falls on the roof, especially hoofed animals have a flight response and they really could hurt themselves. So having some noise is better than having it be silent. But they have very much sensed over the years, it's better to play classical music than, say, classic rock. And I mean, everybody loves the Stones, but it just is not calming, right? And of course, metal's worse. But, you know, classical music, it's good enough for elephants. It's good enough for us.
Yeah. What about NPR? Do you ever play VXU for them? Do they ever catch up with the headlines? Listen to Cincinnati Edition, maybe?
We don't do that, but I listen all the time. But yeah, we tend to not do that.
Well, that counts. I appreciate your listening.
Yeah.
So we talked about 9,000 episodes. Have you ever had any repeats? Have you ever gone back and said, oh, we learned more about owls or some species that than what we told you 10 or 15 years ago?
I haven't specifically done it that way, but I will sometimes do an update when I do hear from an expert, because often the complaints are from real world experts. So say I do a topic on a strange insect. Sure enough, the college professor in Bozeman, Montana, who's the world expert on that, sends me an email and says, you know, you are woefully inadequate in your understanding of the species. Because all these stories are very complex. And when you squish them into 90 seconds, that's not enough. But I will, on those, I usually will respond and on the air and say, gosh, heard from an active listener. And really, this is more what it's really like.
Yeah.
Sometimes when things, I think, for the general public and in the press get boiled and boiled and boiled down, they might not have all the details. I usually, though, will joke with them and say on a note, send them back, you know, I'm not the National Geographic Society. I'm just telling stories on the radio.
Right. I'm talking with Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Director Thane Maynard about his 35 years as the 92nd Naturalist and his work at the zoo. So of all those stories you've told, those 9,000 episodes, do you have favorites? Or are there ones that just kind of stick in your mind or that maybe people ask you about over and over again?
Well, I get a lot of comments, and some people think I talk about poop too much.
I firmly believe poop is science.
Yeah,
absolutely. I believe that, yes. Okay.
Well, there are grad students that their entire graduate study is collecting poop or collecting urine. I mean, it's all in a plop. It's all in a drop. And zoos play a big role in that because it's easier to get, say, lion poop at a zoo than it is to get it in Africa.
Sure.
Animal mating and sex, some people say I say too much. Obviously, it's also essential. And there are a lot of strategies in nature, so that makes it interesting. I, from out west, get complaints sometimes if I talk too much about conservation or wolves or good guys, because ranchers don't think that, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they'll say, son, you increasingly sound like an Easterner, which is their way of being critical.
Yeah.
My two harshest critics One was a woman who was a retired college professor, and she would not write me back in the day when people wrote, not sent emails. She would not put my name on it. She would address it to the happy optimist at the Cincinnati Zoo. And the first time I opened the letter, it said, "You are a public nuisance."
Wow.
And her premise was the world's on fire.
Yeah.
Diversity's being lost. Nature's on the run. And you're telling everybody something good happened in Brazil. Like, you know, come on. And she wanted me to get angry. And that didn't work.
Yeah.
And yeah, anyway, sometimes there are other critics, but, you know, you ride it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I do want to get to Fiona, our star, our favorite. I mean, Fritz is adorable, but no, there will never be another Fiona.
You're not kidding.
Yeah. She was born in January 2017, about 6 months after the tragic death of Harambe.
Yeah.
Talk to us about just the miracle of Fiona and that timing, and also how you stayed positive and focused, how you and the whole zoo team did in that 6 months leading up to her birth, and then in those early weeks when we all didn't know if Fiona was going to survive.
It was quite a time. Yeah, 2016 was a hard one at the zoo. You know, the loss of animals at the zoo is tragic, even if it's just from old age. Certainly no one had ever expected that circumstance to happen. That exhibit had been there since 1978, inspected every year by the USDA, inspected every 5 years for accreditation through the Zoo Association. Big stainless steel railing, you know, substantial. And yet, a 3.5-year-old boy didn't realize the rules and ended up in there, and he was at great risk. And, you know, it was a very hard day. It was hardest on the keepers who knew Harambe so well. And of course, as irony would have it, if you remember his photos, he was the best looking gorilla anybody ever saw.
So beautiful.
Really something. And so it was a terrible loss. And people would say at the time, gosh, do you second guess? And of course, you second guess everything when something bad happens. But we would do the same thing today. No, Harambe was not trying to hurt him. If he'd tried to hurt him, he would have hurt him. On the other hand, Harambe weighed 450 pounds, and that little kid was 3.5 years old.
Yeah.
And he was getting dragged around the exhibit by his heel and banging his head on concrete. And so we made a hard call. The local community was very supportive. Really was only a few people that I interacted with were critical. But on the web, through things like Twitter, man alive, people eat you alive.
Mm-hmm.
So that was challenging. But we stood by the fact that we had work to do, and we did it. We did our job. People wanted us to point the finger, blame the mom, blame everybody else, but that doesn't help. Doesn't help at all. Anybody who's ever had kids know sometimes, like, wait, where in the heck's my child, you know? So, unfortunately, things do happen, and that was a sequence of events that was tough. But, as you said, 6 months later, when Fiona was born, that was the darndest thing because... You know, you mentioned Fritz, who's our new baby, who was born at full term. And the day he was born, he was like a little pig. He was strong.
Yeah.
The keepers got in to pull him out of the deep end of water. And as soon as they moved, he plowed through the straw and got right back in the water. Well, that wasn't Fiona for months. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they first picked her up that day, they said she felt like some skin with no muscle in it. It was just there. But this had never been done before. Nobody even photographed premature hippos before. They normally are, just like ours was, active underwater the day they're born, nursing underwater, climbing on their mom. But she just laid there. And the keepers who really stepped up, all young women that work in our hippo and our Africa area, just remarkable. A thing we called Team Fiona.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the day she was born, I went down to the barn. I'm looking at her. She's laying there completely still. And this one young woman, this is the first time they've ever been zookeepers, leans over to the other and says, "We can do this."
Aww.
And I thought, those girls are going to get their hearts broken.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't true. They kept going. I mean, day and night, 24 hours a day, sleeping with her, holding her, keeping her oxygen tube in. You might remember the part of, I want to say 6 weeks or maybe 8 weeks in, she was getting dehydrated and had diarrhea. And the vets couldn't hit a vein. Even though she was small, hips are naturally fat. You know, you can see our veins, you can't see their veins.
Mm-hmm.
And someone from our marketing department, whose daughter had been in the hospital for a long time, said, "Well, you know, over at Children's, they've got these nurses, and they just bring them in and they hit it." And so we called, and two nurses came over, And literally, they were like a SWAT team. They looked at the keepers and said, you can stop crying because there's never been a vein we can't hit.
That's great.
And they used, you know, ultrasound system and little guns and bang, just there she was. And she's gained weight ever since. She's over 2,000 pounds now. Yeah. So, yeah, her phenomenon of how people love her so much all over the world is unprecedented in my experience, really something like lightning in a bottle.
Yeah. And I imagine, is she the animal people ask you about most?
She is, yeah. I mean, this isn't the only point, but it's an example. She's the only animal you've ever had that pays her own way. I mean, you know, T-shirts, beer, ice cream, I mean, Fiona's brand.
Yeah, she's probably paying for all of Hippo Cove at this point.
Yeah, but you know, Fritz, he's doing his own because this last weekend, you might remember, it rained a lot, Labor Day weekend, and yet we had 7,000 people a day. In a rainy day, that's just not what's going to happen. So I think Fritz was driving that.
Yeah, he's pretty darn cute. I love how he's trying to chase after Fiona, mm-hmm. too, and BB's chasing after him, saying, back off, buddy, not yet. So
I know.
They have a really cute, sweet relationship. It looks like it's going to be a good bloat.
Well, when Tucker came from San Francisco Zoo, I thought, oh, man, this makes me nervous because he's big. He's 4,200 pounds. His head is so big. It was like Fiona could fit in his mouth at the time. But just like in a lot of families, BB's the matriarch, and she made it extremely clear, Tucker, this is not your pool, this is my pool. So if you come, and you'll see on his skin, he's fine. This is what hippos do, but he's got some scratches where, you know, BB said, you need to back up, mister. But they obviously got along and bred, and it's worked. So, yeah, BB makes sure everything stays the way it should be.
Yeah, they sure did get along. I mean, she was she was pregnant with Fritz before you all really anticipated that. Did that make you nervous based on what had happened with Fiona?
You know, it's a phenomenon. There's so much work done in zoos, done at our zoo and others on reproductive biology. But we don't seem to get the dosage of birth control on hippos correct. Because BB was born by mistake. At Disney's Animal Kingdom, when they first opened, they had 8 females and a male, but all the females were on birth control, so they wouldn't have too many. Well, they got the dosage wrong, and they had 8 babies the next year.
Oh, my goodness.
So she grew up at St. Louis Zoo and then came here in 2016. So same thing. She was on birth control. We thought, that'll be fine. We're just going to let everybody settle in. But, you know, life finds a way.
Yeah.
The part that makes me nervous is, of course, Fiona. Fiona's still small. She's over 2,000 pounds, but she's petite. And we don't want her to breed. She's not cycling yet. She is on birth control, but we've proven birth control doesn't always work. So whether she breeds someday, I don't know, but it'd be nice if it wasn't this soon.
She will never leave though, right?
She's staying. She's our franchise player. She'll be here when Joe Burrow retires.
That's good. Good. That's what I want to hear. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Director Thane Maynard. The 92nd Naturalist airs at 7:30 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.9 WGUC and at 9 p.m. on 91.7 WVXU and at various times on stations across North America. Thank you so much for your time today, Thane. It's been fun.
Lucy, good to see you.
Great to see you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Assistant producer is Nick Swartzell. Technical director is Derek Smith. Our theme music was composed by Rob Fetters. I'm Lucy May.